Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Flacco, end zone. Caught. Touchdown, Dennis Pitta. Toby Gerhardt in field goal range. And a lot more. Toby Gerhardt. Touchdown, Vikings. Look out. Jacoby Jones. Jacoby Jones. Touchdown. And the rookie is loose. With one man to get past, and he puts a move on. Look at Patterson go. I don't believe this. Touchdown, Vikings. Joe Flacco. Back of the end zone. That's Marlon Brown for a touchdown.
And that is the voice of Chris Myers of Fox Sports. He's our guest on the new Sports Media Watch podcast. But first, we're going to talk some other sports media news of the week. And of course, I'm John Lewis, joined as always by Armand Brody and Derek Futterman. Please subscribe to the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Before we get into our interview with Chris Myers, which is in the second half of this pod, we're going to start with a little bit of the news of the week. And it was a fairly slow week in sports media, certainly not slow in the world, but in our little neck of the woods in sports media, it was very slow. We'll start with really the biggest news, Paramount and Warner Brothers Discovery. Paramount, Skydance is apparently interested in buying all of Warner Brothers Discovery, a move that would consolidate two very significant television brands. So the Paramount Skydance deal that was reached earlier this year ultimately didn't change all that much, right? It did not combine anything. Skydance was not operating television networks or there's Skydance Sports, but they're just a production company. This, on the other hand, would combine CNN and CBS News. And we know all the implications of that with all of the interest in CBS News and content. But for our purposes, combine CBS Sports and TNT Sports. And these are two sports divisions that people assume are combined because of their NCAA men's basketball tournament deal, but they are not. They are separate entities. That NCAA men's basketball tournament deal is a very unique deal that was of a very specific time when CBS was so cash-strapped that they actually were willing to pay ESPN to take the rest of the NCAA rights off of its hands, for those of you who might remember when that broke back in about 2010. So it's a unique deal, but they're not siblings. Although they have worked together before as well on the Winter Olympics back in the 90s. So I understand the confusion. But this would basically, CBS has never had, with all due respect to CBS Sports Network, right? And We Need to Talk and Jim Rome, and I guess McLovin is still there, Andrew Perloff. With all due respect to those folks, CBS has never had a real sports cable network. It's never had one. There was a time way, way back when they first started having the NCAA play-in game. That ended up being on ESPN, so the precursor to the first four. But originally, it was on, I guess, Spike TV? Or was it the new TNN at that time? Anyone in here remember the new TNN? You remember that, Armand?
I remember WWF used to be on TNN back in like the early 2000s. I do remember that. We're going back a ways here.
Yeah, we are. It was the Nashville Network, then became the National Network. Then it became the new TNN. Anyway, long story short, CBS has never had a real cable option. And so TBS and TNT, those are real cable options. That changes the calculus for CBS completely going forward. Because now you have a circumstance where you don't just have a cable option, you have some of the most iconic cable sports networks of all time. That's what Ted Turner built. Ted Turner built networks in TBS and TNT that for the average sports fan are the equivalent of ESPN in stature and prestige, right? And so to me, if you can get that, TBS and TNT make maybe all of that debt a little bit worth it. But of course, they're not just wanting the cable networks, because they could have the cable networks. Nothing would stop them after this spinoff from just getting those cable networks. They want the studios and they want the streamer as well. That's where I think this deal probably runs aground, because ultimately the reason for the spinoff is because those studios and streamers are going to be very valuable to an Apple, to a Google. And these aren't my thoughts. These are, you know, everyone's saying that. Very valuable to an Apple, to a Google, to an Amazon, in a way that I don't necessarily think that Paramount can compete with.
Well, if you combine both of their streaming services, you'd have about 204 million subscribers, which has to ring antitrust bells all over the place in competition. It would be one of the largest streaming services in the world if you were to combine HBO Max and Paramount Plus. But let's remember that when Warner Media had the merger with Discovery in 2022, they had about $55 billion of debt, $20 billion of which has been paid down. So you have a company that is in debt right now, most of which would go to Discovery Global if the merger is complete. Discovery Global, of course, would include those cable networks, which includes TNT Sports, and again, said to be developing a streaming service specific to TNT Sports. But I think it would be really interesting to see if we did see some consolidation here. I thought the more likely outcome, and still think the more likely outcome, is we potentially down the road see a merger of Versant with Discovery Global, which would then create a more valuable company, could generate more EBITDA in the financial world, and just become something that could work with third-party rights providers and other places to provide sports content. But if you saw a merger between Paramount and Warner Brothers Discovery, as you mentioned, already a relationship there from working together on March Madness, it would definitely create a huge sports portfolio that would only really discount the NBA. Outside of that, you would have most other properties included there. So interesting to see what'll happen.
I don't know about Versant, and there's a point where you have too many cable networks. You don't want to have, oh, we've got USA and TNT and TBS. I mean, already TNT and TBS, they complement each other, but making those brands distinct was a very difficult thing. That's the reason why they came up with, and Armand, I know you remember this, We Know Drama and Very Funny. Because trying to make TBS and TNT distinct brands, well, how do you do that? So you add USA to that. Now you have three basically identical channels, which would be entertainment channels that carry sports, right? You might as well bring FX in there too. I'm sure Disney would be glad to shed at least the linear channel if they could retain the brand and for streaming. I mean, at that point, you would have to get rid of some of them. That's my thought on the Versant comparison. Now, if you bring in Golf Channel, that'd be great, right? Golf Channel would be great. But then that's also a little bit out of the strategic approach as well, because neither CBS nor TNT Sports have ever really had, other than the licensing agreement for NBA TV, a sports-specific channel. So I don't know. That one, I don't know how much I agree that that would be the way to go. But I definitely think that those cable channels, I can't see too many other places valuing them as much as Paramount would.
I just really have a thought about whether or not this is really feasible. In that Wall Street Journal report, there was, you know, the talk about Paramount, Skydance, and the fact that they'd be trying to acquire a company that has a market cap that is twice its size. So you guys are sort of more well-versed on this than I am. Is this realistic? I'm putting myself in the position of the fans who would say, oh, it might be pretty neat to have CBS and TNT under the same umbrella. Is this really feasible and something we could look forward to happening down the road realistically?
Larry Ellison's net worth went up by about $100 billion this week. They just got the Paramount Skydance merger done. He's said to be backing this potential transaction. And again, no bid has been made, according to the Journal right now, but they're certainly mulling it over. And keep in mind that with the reported interest from Paramount, I would not be surprised to see some technology companies maybe jump in here either. Would Apple or Amazon want to have a cable television presence, something that you can maybe then spin off into your streaming service? ESPN is trying to be a hub for sports everywhere. Do we see a technology company maybe trying to compete with that in making these acquisitions? It's certainly, I think, a move, though, that when we talk about the split of Warner Brothers Discovery, which David Zaslav said this week at an investor conference, would probably take place in Q2 next year, thinking around April. and then just days later, this comes out. Obviously, I have to think this would prevent that transaction from happening. Warner Brothers Discovery splitting into Warner Brothers with streaming studios and then Discovery Global with the networks.
I definitely think it would be certainly a bold move. Realistically, it would not be a move that I think would be approved by the government in most circumstances, but we are not in most circumstances. So I think as long as the Ellisons say the right things and are friendly in the right way, I think they will probably be able to. And of course, because they have made certain commitments on the news side, there's a view that, oh, well, give them CNN too, right? Look, I mean, it's interesting, that's for certain. I do wonder if they quite know what they're doing. I think they're the only ones out there at Paramount right now trying to save those cable networks. I think cable is a great model for live sports, but that's it. And, you know, there was the article by Jessica Tunkel of the Wall Street Journal who broke the news about this. She had another article earlier in the week, or I guess last week, about Paramount's trying to revitalize their cable networks. You can't revitalize MTV. You can't revitalize Comedy Central. I mean, now, to be fair, Comedy Central has South Park, and South Park is as relevant this year as it's ever been. The Daily Show, not really that relevant, even with Jon Stewart being back, but they have shows that make headlines sometimes. But that brand is over. I mean, unless you're going to turn Comedy Central into a streaming brand that just happens to have a basic cable outpost. So what I say, do they really know what they're doing? You know, how many cable networks do you want to have in 2025? I mean, how many cable networks do you want to have? Because you already have your own. You're not going to sell them. You're going to bring in the TNT ones as well. That would have been too many cable networks 20 years ago.
But does it matter? I mean, they just may want to make this acquisition because of the streaming, because of the studios, because the market cap is twice the size. And remember, Warner Brothers Discovery, a top priority for the company and something that's going to continue should this split happen, is paying down that debt. Shares of Warner Brothers Discovery were trading the stock market 30% higher when that Wall Street Journal report came out on Thursday. I think if you look at it from a shareholder perspective, it's pay down the debt and worry about the cable networks later.
Yeah, but then the cable networks die out and you're stuck with all of these, you know, I mean, it makes sense for Warner Brothers Discovery, I'm sure. I just don't know if it makes sense for Paramount. And, you know, I would also say that this, if you want the streaming in studios, I guess the reason, maybe it is the case that instead of them looking at the cable networks and saying, oh, we want the cable networks, it's more along the lines of, we're willing to take the cable networks too, if we can get the streaming in studios, which obviously Amazon, you know, you suggested maybe Amazon would want to have a cable network. To me, that's like, well, you know, maybe Tesla would want to have an Oldsmobile, you know? I mean, it doesn't really follow to me. It's a little bit like, if you're not in cable, why would you ever anchor yourself to that? Which again, if you're talking about live sports, cable is still relevant, still a major player. But, you know, MTV's lineup is literally just ridiculousness, literally and figuratively. It's just ridiculousness, right? And so to me, I wouldn't want to take on any more like that. And, you know, they already own MTV. TBS and TNT are not as dead as Paramount's cable networks are. And they do have live sports. But, you know, like, for example, you're picking up True TV. What are you going to do with that other than simulcasts of TNT sports? All their original programming is gone.
Yeah, I mean, the question I have to ask, and Armand, curious here, like from your point of view as a consumer, is getting the cable networks the sacrifice to get the more lucrative streaming and studios business, and then you could potentially spin it off to a company that would have interest or maybe private equity at that point?
In answering that question, I think about what John just said. As a consumer, what's going to get me to cable other than live sports? Nothing else. Nothing else is going to get me there. And so I think also about what John just said about the streamers as well. And do you want to get into the cable television business? And it doesn't seem like a proper fit. All the consumers want to know ultimately is, how can I get to where I want to get to, the games that I want to watch, for as low a price point as possible and enjoy as much of the portfolio that that network or that combination of networks has? That's really all the consumers ultimately want to know. And if, because let's face it, live sports is basically keeping cable television especially alive, and I use the word alive in quotation marks, if that's where it is, then that's where the viewers are going to go, because that's really what the consumers really care about. So if that can be provided in a way that makes things palatable for the viewer, I think consumers will adjust.
All right, we'll leave that there. Obviously, we'll be reading more and more about that prospect as the weeks go along, I'm sure. But let's talk about some of the other things that went on this past week. And you can't talk about sports media in the first week of September without talking about ratings for the National Football League. And it was the most watched week one on record, although that comes with the obvious caveat about Nielsen and its various methodological changes. And we have three different methodological changes to talk about. So one, the week one average, most watched week one on record, does not include the YouTube game. That is not included. The YouTube game used a different methodology than the other games. You might have seen Flora Kelly of ESPN complaining about it on social media. Michael Mulvihill didn't actually complain about the methodology, but he did complain about the lack of transparency that he felt that the networks were being subjected to. So controversial measurement figure for the YouTube game. Frankly, I'm not even really sure who the comparison is unfair to, because based on what I've read, it almost seems like the YouTube game didn't get the big data boost that everybody else is getting. So it might be that YouTube got shortchanged. But either way, it's not apples to apples, and it's not included in that week one average. But we probably should talk about it right off the top because it has been a headline-making number. Now, through the magic of editing, I'm going to cut in here. We taped Friday. I'm talking to you now on Sunday, because the rest of this discussion about YouTube's NFL number is based on the original viewership figure that YouTube reported last week. But after we taped the podcast on Friday, YouTube came out and said that they had undercounted the audience for that Chargers-Chiefs game, and that it was actually 18.5 million viewers. You can read about that on SMW. The rest of this discussion with me and Armand and Derek is from Friday before that correction came out. So we'll be talking about the 16.2 million that was originally reported. 16.2 million plus another million overseas, far below what I think a lot of people expected. I'll put my cards on the table and say that I thought that could get 30 million viewers. Now, obviously, that was a dumb prediction, right? It didn't come anywhere close to that. But here was my logic. YouTube is free. It's not just free, it's familiar. People of all ages watch YouTube all the time. I've said before on this podcast, your older relatives will watch YouTube and then they'll come and ask you about the misinformation that they saw on YouTube. Like, hey, is Clint Eastwood dead? No, Clint Eastwood's alive. Someone may have put a video up there that said he was dead, but he's alive, right? This is literally what I've dealt with before. So the fact that all ages watch it, it's free. The game was available for free. It's the Chargers, it's the Chiefs, and YouTube is the biggest source of viewing anywhere. And, you know, this number, 16.2 million, realistically, isn't even a number that I would consider all that impressive for a Thursday night football game. I mean, granted, it would be at worst the third largest Thursday night football audience. But given week one, Chargers, Chiefs, I would expect better from Amazon in that window. And Amazon does quite well. I'm not suggesting Amazon's a lower status thing, but given the hype around the YouTube game, did YouTube get its money's worth? Probably not for that audience. I think they expected more viewers too. I know it wasn't a ratings play for them, but it's a rare occasion when the National Football League has to have cold water thrown on it from a ratings perspective. And that is exactly what happened with that YouTube number.
I don't want to stretch it too far, but I do think it's worth mentioning. Before I say what I'm going to say, I'll mention that I did not watch the game. I didn't watch the game because it was a Friday night. I was at a high school football game, which I would imagine a lot of people are. Why? Because it's Friday night in September, and that's what a lot of people do. But I think to go back to my original question now, after that little parenthetical part, is the NFL, and we talked about this last time we spoke, Is the NFL spreading itself too thin? Could this become a part of a narrative? Could this be something that takes the minds of sports media followers and columnists, etc., to the place where we say, is the juice worth the squeeze here? Because that number, to see 16 million on YouTube, it's a disappointing number. It's a surprising number to many. John, you even said, and there are very few people who are as respected at this as you are, you said 30 million, and they barely got over half that. So I guess it makes me wonder if people are not willing on a Friday night to really shift and adjust their lives to the degree that a Chiefs-Chargers game on YouTube is going to draw them in, what does that say about the fact or the question of whether or not the league could end up spreading itself too thin if they continue doing things like this down the line?
Well, I mean, let's really put all our cards out on the table. I don't know that the NFL's audience has actually recovered from the Kaepernick years as much as we all think it has. Right? Like I've said before, how are we supposed to know what the viewership is when every year there's a methodological change? And like, for example, this was the most watched week one on record, but like NBC, the kickoff game had 28.3 million viewers, but 5 million of that is Adobe Analytics. Nielsen only, that's 23.3 million. And yeah, I know you have this weather delay, but that's by the standards of a kickoff game involving the Cowboys and Eagles, it's not that great of a number. And then you factor in that it includes big data, it includes maxed out of home viewing. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, in 2018, might have thought that maybe we might have looked at that number as indicative of, oh, well, the NFL, they went woke and now they're broke, you know? Like, I don't know that the NFL's viewership has actually bounced all the way back. Like, I'll put it this way. I'm just going to say it. I guarantee you fewer people are watching the NFL in 2025 per game than we're watching in 2015. I mean, this is those household ratings in 2015, you were getting a 16 rating. The national window on Sunday, it was an 11 rating. So the household ratings are the one piece of data that is the same now as it was back then, and they're not even close, right? So you talk about, is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the NFL spreading itself too thin? I mean, yeah, anything's possible. I don't know if we'll ever be able to definitively say that, but I think anything's possible.
I am of the belief, and you and I have talked about this. We talked about this when we did the schedule release episode months back. And I use the word sacred, talking about Sunday afternoon. That still applies to me. You know, I mean, even the Washington-Green Bay game, we're taping on Friday, the Washington-Green Bay game from Thursday Night Football. I really didn't watch it, not much of it. And we were talking before we taped. John, you and Derek, we really didn't watch the game. John, you didn't watch at all. And so there's something sacred still about Sunday afternoon. And I think we don't want to overreact to Kansas City, LA, but considering the teams involved and considering that Kansas City has been so heavily relied upon whenever the NFL wants to expose itself in a different way via a different broadcaster, considering those elements, the number stands out. And it does cause me to just say to myself, man, I think the ship has left and taken off, but Sunday afternoon is still sacred. And to tinker with it in so many different ways, it could be. I would not be upset if somebody said, aha, you know, told you so. Stop it. Stop the Friday stuff. Like, we're not changing. We're not moving. I'm going to my cousin's football game. I'm going to my son's high school football game. And I'm not going to let you tempt me with some Kansas City game in Brazil with bells and whistles. Screw you, NFL. I could imagine maybe somebody thinking that way and looking at that number and feeling somewhat vindicated about it.
Yeah, I mean, let's be completely real. The only reason all of these things the NFL has done are perceived in the way that they're perceived is because the changes in Nielsen methodology have given us a perhaps slightly distorted view of the trajectory of the NFL audience. Now, look, hey, the NFL is not the NBA, where we know that the viewership is. All the Nielsen bells and whistles haven't helped the NBA. They haven't really helped baseball if you don't have the Yankees and Dodgers involved. The NFL is at least showing some positive impacts from it, which indicates that the NFL, at worst, is at least handling the changes in TV viewing better than the other leagues. But I could easily buy, and I think I do buy, the argument that these extensions of the NFL into other places are not as effective as the league would have everyone believe. And as you said, Armand, people have other things to do. And all the Nielsen changes are doing is getting us closer to seeing what the actual audience is every Sunday for the NFL. That audience may not actually be growing. Just Nielsen's ability to capture it, right? And in fact, that audience may be shrinking. But as Nielsen's ability to capture that audience grows, we will have, oh, the most watched this, the most watched that. And yeah, maybe that audience is shrinking at a lower level than that of the NBA or baseball. And that still means the NFL is doing great. But I tend to believe that, one, the recovery from the Kaepernick protest years, and you can debate whether or not it was Kaepernick or not, I don't believe that recovery has been quite as successful as everyone would say. And beyond anything else, the NFL is just a TV program in an era where people are watching less TV. It's just a TV show when people are watching less TV. Why in the world should it be the case that we're believing that it's just attracting more and more viewers as opposed to the opposite?
And there's no real constant off which to compare anymore because we're in a new era with big data. So these conversations are essential to really make context of the ratings properly. And yeah, you could completely make the argument that the NFL audience could be shrinking, even though it may not look that way. But certainly a lot of companies were saying most watched game, certainly touting the numbers. And it's just interesting to see how it's communicated these days. But I think the biggest win for YouTube is having a game broadcast that really didn't have too many glitches. The presentation was good. It's a start, and we'll see if it can expand the relationship between the NFL and Google. I mean, we already see YouTube with Sunday Ticket. I'd be curious to see if maybe they're in the running for an international package down the road.
But it sounds like our main takeaway here is don't buy what the NFL is selling when it comes to all these numbers, because there's more than meets the eye.
And I would say, I think, honestly, the expansion of out-of-home viewing is a bigger factor than big data. Big data systematically will result in games having bigger audiences than last year because we're comparing big data to panel only, right? That is the policy. What's interesting to me, like, for example, it seems to me that whatever viewership figures for the individual games were reported earlier this year will remain the official figures. But, for example, ESPN today put out a press release about its WNBA audience this year. The WNBA season, most of it happened before big data became the currency. But the average is based on big data. I asked ESPN specifically, is it combining the panel-only games from before September 1st with the big data games after September 1st? No, it's just big data across the board. Even though the individual games from earlier this year are still officially the panel-only number. So, for example, the top game this year in the WNBA was 2.7 million for Sky Fever on the first weekend of play. That's a panel-only viewership figure, and that's still the figure that ESPN is reporting. But in the average, that number is probably 2.9, 3 million, whatever the big data figure was, because the whole season is big data. It's all very convoluted. I mean, it's the most convoluted time in ratings that I can remember, and it's inopportune because people use the ratings as an opinion poll, but because they don't know anything about the ratings, they lack the skepticism that they bring to opinion polls, right? Any poll you put out there, oh, this is a lie, this poll was made up. But they don't have that with ratings because they don't know how ratings work. They assume, I guess, that the ratings are all tracked from your TVs and anything you do is tracked. In reality, it's an estimate from a company that's changing its methodology relatively frequently. And if it was an opinion poll, if it was Gallup doing this, people would probably not I mean, people already don't buy the Gallup results that have come out just this year. Oh, Gallup sample, it might be too Democratic this time. And that's why. Yeah, but they don't have that level of skepticism when it comes to Nielsen. I'm not saying that you shouldn't trust them, but it's a private company making estimates and changing its methodology almost every single year. So some level of distance and not just taking it as fact is required.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
And now we'll get to the main event of this podcast. We had Chris Myers of Fox Sports join us today. We talked about his career journey and other issues in the industry. And what's interesting is he actually doesn't have a game this week. Chris Myers obviously is one of the Fox NFL play-by-play voices, but he is going to be sitting at home this Sunday. So we started out by asking him, well, what exactly does an NFL play-by-play voice do when they don't have to work a game during one of the weeks?
Yeah, it is a rarity. I have, in the past, I've kind of filled in sometimes in the studio for Kurt Menefee and in our Fox pregame shows. But this time I'm actually, since there was Thursday baseball, we have another Thursday baseball next week where we have the Yankees on Baseball Night in America. So this weekend, yeah, when it does happen, it's very unusual. But I sit home on Sundays like most fans, and I watch from, you know, the earliest show till the end of Sunday night football, and I'm a viewer, and it's great. I'll have certain games. The next game I have is the Raiders playing in Washington, and the Raiders play Monday night, so I'll be glued to that. But I love flipping around and watching, you know, certainly the players, the games that I'll be doing during the course of the season. We get our schedule a couple weeks in advance, and then it shifts a lot now with flexing and streaming, so that's why the schedule gets a little quirky. But yeah, I watch it. The hard part is I try to watch as you do a little homework, but I'm enjoying it because I love football and doing the games. But then I also critique a little bit sometimes if broadcasters say certain things. I wouldn't have said that, or boy, they missed this, or some of the production values in different types of things. So it really is a lot of fun. Usually my son will come over, we'll hang out and watch and talk about, because he's certainly into some fantasy leagues and survivor pools and that kind of stuff. So it's a lot of fun, and then it prepares me for the Sunday when I work.
And as far as those Sundays that you're working, obviously you get, sometimes you fall into one of those great games. I was thinking just the other day about the, obviously he's kind of not necessarily someone people like to talk about now, but Justin Tucker, when he had, I think it was like a chip shot to win a game not too long ago, maybe a few years, and he missed it. And your call was,
"Are you kidding me?"
And, I was wondering, in the long sweep of your career, what calls jump out as the ones that are most memorable to you?
Yeah, well, you know, they do happen naturally. You know, at least I don't sit there and say, "Hey, I'm going to say this in a big moment." I had another game for it was a Bears game, and it was a comeback, and the crowd at home was, you know, they were an underdog, and I think I just said, "Well, it was a long distance field goal, 50, whatever it was," and I just said the crowd will tell you, the home crowd in town will tell you if the Bears win, you know, win this and if the kick is good. And so I just laid out and I sailed through and the crowd went crazy and I didn't really need to say anything. I remember the Justin Tucker that you were talking about. What stood out about that is he had a consecutive extra point string of whatever it was, the top of my head now, I can't remember. But I happened to mention that beforehand. And so the Raven fans were, you know, at the time, and announcer Jinx, you should have said anything. So we sometimes say that after he makes it, you know, hey, he's got a hot streak going, and then you add the number to it. So are you kidding me, was a real shock. I was stunned by that. And that's where, you know, the expression of the book I wrote last year that came out, that deserves a wow. That was kind of a something that was just wow. That word sometimes, even when I was doing SportsCenter on highlights, we'd be watching and somebody would make a great catch or whatever. So those are the kinds of things that I think they're the kinds of things you just asked. And I would say if I was sitting with people watching a football game, I mean, obviously sometimes you can't. You have to watch your language if you get a little too excited. But I've had a few, the wow thing, and that's how that deserves a wow, because I just got tired of saying wow. After it was a game in the snow with the Ravens and the Vikings. It was like a dull game until the fourth quarter, and then there was like an exchange of, 20 points each and in a matter of seconds with each team. So I think those are the things that kind of come out naturally, as long as you're identifying. That's the good thing about television, right? The network broadcast, people can see it. And then you can get back to the details, as long as you set them up properly about, hey, this, this is in the moment. There have been some other crazy plays that weren't necessarily game winners. But you try to be as natural and as authentic as you can be, and yet being as professional and making sure the viewer is clued in on everything, even in those crazy, unexpected moments.
Hey, Chris, what's it like preparing for an NFL broadcast? Take us through what you go through during the week to prepare.
Yeah, and it's something that I enjoy, and I think a lot of the former players who become analysts, I've worked with Rondé Barber recently, now I work with Mark Schlereth and Mark Sanchez, I've worked with Daryl Johnston, I was on, the crew with, the Super Bowl crew with Troy Aikman, when we did a couple of Super Bowls, when the Chiefs first won, going back when Brady came back with his amazing comeback, and it's a cool process. I mean, early in the week for the play-by-play guy, for me, we don't do the same team usually every week, so they change, I might have the Rams, Texans one week, and then the Raiders, Washington the next. So as soon as I'm on that plane coming home from the last game with Fox, I'll be checking out the roster to learn more about attaching names and numbers and the personnel, the current personnel on those teams that we're going to be going over. So I'm not really memorizing, but I'm just becoming more familiar. Obviously, I watch a lot of football when I'm not working. And then we get video of the games and we get clips. You can get coaches' clips. But the best part, I think, you study a little on your own during the course of the week. You're reading, you're watching the daily news conferences that the teams have. You get in on the home team Friday and you get to go to their practice. So we have access that they close practice to other parts of the media, but not the network crew. And we get to watch that, and usually our analyst is clued in. And then we meet, production meetings, we call them. We get three or four guys, including the head coach, and they sit down and they casually talk with us. It's not recorded. They fill us in on certain things. We can ask questions about that, things that help us. Our producer, director are sitting in that meeting as well, so they know to get cameras on certain people for the viewer. And then on the Saturday, the visiting team comes in, and we go meet with them at their hotels. We don't get to see their practice, but we talk with them. And then we have a Saturday night meeting, kind of a production dinner to go over, graphics to show, storylines to watch, get a good night's rest, and then get up and rock and roll and go with the action, go with the flow of the game. Now, we are prepared for certain things. Hey, Travis Hunter, it's his first game. He's going to play offense and defense. So let's show what that means in terms of, let's have a graphic that keeps up to date the stats of snaps and those kinds of things. You think a little ahead, but then you go with the flow in the game. ETN was the star, ran for over 120 or 40 yards, whatever it was. So you got to follow that. And then when the game ends, we all fly home to whatever city and get ready for the next game. So that's kind of the sped up process. And in between, we're talking with each other a little bit about the game and the certain players to highlight.
Now, Chris, this is your second year in the booth with Mark Schlereth. How have you guys built rapport, and what are you looking to improve on here in year two?
Yeah, I did his audition for the games when he came over from ESPN after years in the studio, and he was a natural. I mean, he's got the broad. A lot of the guys have the football knowledge, but it takes them a while to get the broadcast part of it. And by that, I mean the voice, and if your voice has to cut through when the crowd's going. They don't see you on camera all the time. Necessarily, you've got to, athletes, they see three or four things on one play and you can't fit them all in. They got to pick the best one and work it in on a replay. And he's great at that. I mean, so is Mark Sanchez, the guys that I've worked with. But he also has a sense of humor, which I'm big on in between plays or in those funny moments when you have something that happens, a certain shot of a player, a guy sliding. You're never making fun of players, but you're having fun in the flow of the game if there's something with the fans. So, yeah, it's I think that is an important part of that. And we all kind of learned, I know when John Madden was part of things at Fox, he set up, you know, hey, a Friday night dinner with the crew, you know, not just the production Saturday, all work, but Friday night where you guys can kind of hang out and talk a little bit and build that kind of chemistry you're talking about so you can reference things when you're calling the game on Sunday.
Now, of course, you spent 11 years at ESPN. And when you were at ESPN, this is a period of time, it's amazing the amount of talent that was there that went on to really become foundational members of the sports media people, like, you know, obviously Chris Fowler, et cetera. And during your period there, you were part of the broadcast for some of the more serious incidents in sports history. So obviously the 1989 World Series, the Earthquake World Series. But I want to ask you specifically about 1996 and the Olympic Park bombing. You were on air on SportsCenter. They've shown the footage before where you're running down highlights. You can hear the explosion in the background. Can you just give some background on what that night was like?
Yeah, well, and it changed dramatically. And you're right about it. Those are some, I call them the growth years, the golden years of ESPN through the 90s, working with, you know, guys like, you know, Tirico and people like Linda Cohn. And you mentioned some of the talent, the SportsCenter anchors, and then reporting, you know, Chris Berman and Bob Lee, of course, the pillars of the network going way back. But yeah, I was actually recording a late SportsCenter update. We were pre-taping that one in the morning because you had to wait for all the Olympic results to end. And I was at the Chamber of Commerce building, which overlooks kind of the Olympic Village garden area there in Atlanta, downtown Atlanta. And so my back was turned to that, and I hear in the middle of it, I'm doing the boxing results, a loud pop. And I thought it might have been fireworks because there's sometimes people were partying and there was stuff going on. So I started to read through, and then we realized that we hear things going on. And so we check it out. We weren't sure. And then people are scrambling. And we saw this panic as if there was a shooting. It wasn't really a shooting. It was a bomb that actually went off. And so the more we thought about it, we saw police come into the building and said we had to leave. And I just said, well, we're here reporting. Is it all right if we stay? I kind of talked my way into with our cameraman of us staying in that downtown area so that we could first find out what was going on and then report it. And again, because SportsCenter could go live, we had the ability to do that overnight. That's what we did when most of the news channels had already shut down or gone home, or they weren't in the middle of all of that area downtown. And then I wandered around with the crew to, there were police barricades and medical units. And it turned out it could have been a lot worse. But in the moment, I mean, it was really, you know, it was at a time when it could have been terrorism with bombs planted everywhere or in different places. And so that was how the story unfolded and how people reacted to it, and how the city handled it. And of course, the secondary part of that was, you know, how would it affect the Olympics? And once they determined what exactly happened. So it was one of those moments where, you know, I'm in there to cover a sporting event and something bigger than that happens. I mean, a news-making event, kind of like the Earthquake World Series with the A's and the Giants. When you're there for baseball and people, you know, people's lives are at stake because of the damage that took place. So if you're a reporter at heart, you probably should be able to adjust to the circumstances, whatever you're covering. But obviously, this escalated to a news event from a sporting event.
And there have been a handful of these kinds of issues, kinds of stories in your career. Obviously, I correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you were covering the aftermath of Hank Gather's passing for SportsCenter as well on site.
Yes, I was the West Coast reporter for ESPN. I was actually at the movies, and they got a hold of me and said, hey, he collapsed on the court at one of the early tournament. It was a game to get into the tournament with Loyola Marymount, LMU. Yeah, Hank Gathers, Bo Kimble's on that team. And anyway, they said, can you rush over to the arena? So we went towards the arena and then towards the hospital because he had collapsed and had a heart issue. We weren't sure at the time. And he ended up dying. But yes, had to kind of uncover live outside the Daniel Freeman Medical Center and then tell the audience. Chris Fowler connected with me at the time. And again, SportsCenter went on live and had to break the news that he had died and then talk to the head coach. And one of the doctors came out, and that was the question. He had had a heart ailment before. Should he have been playing? And you want to be sensitive to the family and people in that moment. But you also say, hey, what, you know, how does something like this happen with the kind of medical preparations that they have with college athletes. So yeah, that was another one of those moments. I mean, they just, and that's one thing, it's a little unusual in the fun and games of sports. You know, you talk about once in a lifetime moments, and there's been some good ones. I mean, exciting moments of watching the Red Sox for the World Series and, you know, Brady's the greatest comeback ever against Atlanta in the Super Bowl with the Patriots. But then there's these other ones that you have mentioned, like Dale Earnhardt, you know, crashing and dying at the Daytona 500 in the first Fox broadcast that I wasn't just there. I was put into a role to report on live for a national audience. And it's a little bit unusual, I got to admit. But I think, you know, each one of those, you just hope that, and you remove yourself for a moment. You are emotional about it. You do feel what's happened, but you try to bring it to the audience in the best way that you can, information-wise, and be sensitive to those that were affected.
Kind of staying along those lines, Chris, you're a respected interviewer, and I'd love to hear from you. What are some of the things you think about as you're doing interviews, either on the sidelines, you've interviewed some of the most important people within a game in some of the biggest games in sports television. What's that process like? What do you think about when you're interviewing people at some of the most critical moments, you know, during a game or even after a championship event?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is as comfortable as you can make that person feel in that moment. And sometimes, as you said, they are quick after a game or after a big moment. Sometimes you have a time to prepare and spend a half hour interview like we're talking on this, or it was a podcast or on Up Close where we had it was one of those unique shows that you had a half hour to sit and talk with an athlete back when they didn't have the kind of reach and social media that we have now. And so it starts out with that, at least in my view. They have to be comfortable so that they'll reveal and talk to you. And you don't ambush people, but you do have to have the kinds of questions and preparation, if you have the time, in the moment, so that you can ask respectfully what, again, you're there not just for your own curiosity, which helps, but you're there for the audience. What do they want to know about? Okay, you fumbled the ball at the end, you lost the, or you made the catch to win it. Yes, there's going to be a moment of excitement, and players often, in those moments, whatever you ask them, they're just going to go into their excitement, and that's okay. But then the second question, you have to dig for a little more information if you have the time in those interviews. And in the longer interviews, you know, you do have to kind of think in your mind, all right, if we're gonna hit any heavy subjects, we go here, but we can, you know, make sure they're comfortable, talk about some things that they enjoyed, high moments in their career, or, you know, growing up, certain things that really gave them the joy in life. That's kind of the way I approached it. And also I learned, I think the second question usually on those quicker interviews, which I would call the follow-up question, that are shorter questions, you sometimes get the best response in those. You know, you can't just say, how did you feel? You might just say, well, describe what the emotions were when you had to, in the huddle, you know, start this drive. And then if they say something, then you could follow and then get more details from that. If you have to, with a quicker response, it could be something as simple as, well, tell me more, or can you expound on that? And that's often when I think you get a lot of interesting information that you might not thought you were going to get. Those are some of the basics.
Now, you've been at Fox for, I believe this is 27th year now, been on NFL broadcast for a majority of that time. How has the NFL presentations on Fox evolved over that time as you've seen new voices join the fold and the presentation adapt to larger changes in the business?
Yeah, going back, I mean, Madden was there, the Troy Aikman, but that was the first year I did a Super Bowl with that crew, and they'd been there forever before they moved on. And now we have Tom Brady as the lead analyst. I think it's always important to have that, you know, through all that in terms of the NFL. I mean, you've had the Terry Bradshaw, Howie Long, you know, that those two, the core on the pre-show. And I think, you know, that means a lot to people. Even talking about, oh, you know, these people have been there. They're, you know, they're older players or whatever, but they played the game and they're familiar. They've been there. They put in the work. I think they get people ready for their games, and they have through the years, really, I guess, through kind of generations when you talk about those. I'm surprised that it's already been more than two decades that I've been at Fox after the time I spent at ESPN. And it really is, a family. And I think in terms of the Fox coverage, I think what I've noticed from the broadcast of games, and this we've seen this across the board in most cases, but you try to stay cutting edge, is the technology. I mean, how great is the audio to hear stuff down on the sidelines, the closer to the action, and also the cameras and the amount of angles, just like the NFL using technology to help with officiating. You know, and it's made the NFL and a lot of sports, so, you know, it's great. Nothing beats being there, right? Whether you're a broadcaster or a real diehard fan, but it's as good as being there. And sometimes, you know, it's almost a better TV sport than in person because of the information you get, as you would with your computer, with graphics or replays. I mean, now you can, with, you know, zoom back on your TV, but there's a lot more enhancements, I think, in that area that make the broadcast better. And Fox, I can tell you that they're constantly, we have great production people. They've always been, with whatever sport I've worked in with them, and especially NFL with Super Bowls and having been on that, that they're always trying to get more cameras, more angles. What else can we do to make it better? And they do. Every year we have a seminar, we go over things, that what works, what doesn't work. And then, of course, the personnel. You know, you try to add, whether sideline reporters, how they can do a better job and enhance things. What else can we do in the booth to connect to make sure viewers enjoy? And I don't know, at the end of the day, they also, you know, sometimes announcers, we talk too much. It's between the pictures and the natural sound and the information we can put on the screen. Yes, give them what they want, but don't over-talk. You know, we're not the stars, at least in a game. The game is the thing. The players are the stars, and that's where it should go. That's different, of course, on pre-shows and post-shows.
Now, when you were at ESPN, and as you said, it was the golden age, and when you were at Fox as well, you were at companies that were really at the beginning of something new and revolutionary in the industry. At this stage, we know the industry is changing dramatically and becoming something entirely new in a lot of ways. From your vantage point, being a veteran of that, having seen it firsthand, well, what do you think about where this sports media industry is heading?
Well, I think social media, I mean, Zooms, the streaming world, it's changed things a lot. It's really opened up the world for a lot more ways and a lot of different people, I think, to talk about sports and to cover sports and to react to sports. And I think ultimately that's a good thing. Look, I mean, we've looked in history going back from, you know, you go from newspapers, you know, to radio, to TV, to, and then there's, you know, of course, satellite radio. It's going to kill AM radio. They still exist, and there's room for everything. And, you know, from network cable TV to network TV to now streaming. And I think it's a great thing that you can be on a device moving somewhere and still watching a football game or watching a sporting event live as it happens. And that's really where it's at. I think live sports is the most, right now it's the hottest property, and for a reason. And it's not just the NFL, even though that's at the top of the chart in that regard. Yeah, and where it's going, I think, you know, more fan involvement, and also gambling has become where that used to be. It's always been there. That used to be off to the side. Now it's more intertwined. And I think that could be a concern in terms of leagues and integrity and how that's controlled. They've already run into a few different types of problems in that area with players or people that are involved in the game that they don't want betting on things, but they do, or they have a family member and there's information. So there's a whole wide open universe out there of where it's going next. I was one that saw, you know, a 24-hour, you know, football network and then other sports, and had a vision too that we would see NFL games beyond Sunday, but to have them on Monday and Thursday. And now, whether it's Christmas, whatever day of the week, you're getting more than one NFL game there. And there's a reason there's an audience for it, there's an appetite. So I don't know where it's exactly going. I'll just say it's going there fast. And I'll say that it has opened up just a lot more opportunity for everybody to enjoy. And we'll, if we go with NFL specifically, but sports in general, you can talk about any sport and the growth that's out there. And I think it's allowed the fan, this is probably the special thing too, and I've talked to players, it's allowed the fan to connect directly to the athletes, to teams, to announcers, broadcasters, in ways to, you know, and not just to criticize, but to comment or just say, hey, we like this. Can we get more of that? You know, and in a way, I think it helps us do our job better, as long as people are not hateful or mean-spirited about it. Everybody has a preference of who they like or why they like certain people. But I think overall, it's really a good thing. And I think it's also brought more people. Sports sometimes used to be pushed to the side of the news, weather world, whatever. I think it's brought more people into that. It's more universal in that sense. Everybody kind of has a hand, or at least has access to it, and not feeling like they're left out, even if they're not a diehard fan that follows a team every week on a regular basis.
All right. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time today. We really appreciate it. It's great talking to you about your career, and best of luck on the rest of the NFL and MLB seasons, and of course, motorsports next year as well. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week's Sports Media Watch podcast, but we're not quite done with the good stuff yet. In fact, we're taping Friday. We had Chris Myers on in the morning, and we will be back to interview James Brown of CBS in the afternoon, and that podcast will be coming out next week, so keep an eye out for that. So thank you to Armand, and thank you to Derek for joining me. Thank you to all of you for listening, and we'll be back with more stuff down the line.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou. forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.